You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @PolicyPodcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Africa Security Initiative at the Foreign Policy Program, and I'm delighted today to welcome Stig Jarle Hansen from the Norwegian Life Sciences University, one of the most intrepid and dedicated Africa field researchers that I know, and also a remarkable author who has written a new book, Horn, Sahel, and Rift, Fault Lines of the African Jihad, which covers really the whole continent and the question of Islamist extremism throughout much of Africa, ranging from the Horn to the western side, throughout the Sahel, and then down even into Mozambique. And so we're here to talk about all that today with you. I'd like to welcome Stig, and he's visiting the United States, and as I say, based in Norway, and a good friend of Vonda Felbab Brown, who's my co-conspirator on the Africa Security Initiative. And I'd like to thank those of you who came today and who have been part of our events in the past as well. So what we really want to do today is just launch in with an overview of the state of so-called jihadism in Africa, and then start to bear down a little bit on country-by-country dynamics or region-by-region dynamics, and also talk about which policies are working, which Western or indigenous policies are working to try to defuse the kinds of pressures and ideologies that can give rise to violent jihadism, and which policies aren't working or are under-resourced or what have you. So that's the basic gist. But Stig, first let me just welcome you to Brookings and ask if you'd like to offer just any broad framing thoughts on how should we think of the state of jihadism in Africa today.
Yeah, I think there are several fault traps when you come to start analyzing these jihadi organizations. Amongst the researchers, it has been some tension between researchers that focus on local networks and local factors creating these groups and some researchers focusing on the international networks. And it's easy to dichotomize too much. The local are very important, and more important perhaps than the global networks, but the global networks are there. And that's something that we should keep in mind when we discuss these organizations. So there are connections between some of these groups. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid that I have to say that they are not really on the defensive, although this seems so when you read some of the reports coming from some of the regional organizations, the local actors, and some of the international organizations involved in the area as well. If you go to the West, we have several army offensives in Nigeria against the Islamic State of Western Africa. The problem with Nigeria is that some of the Nigerian services tend to overestimate their own success. I had a meeting with several Nigerian generals, I think 1.5 months ago. They would say that the Islamic State in Western Africa didn't hold any cities. I had friends close to those cities. I called them and they confirmed that they were holding those cities. We see offensives against the former organizations of Boko Haram, but we also see that they are resilient. They are withstanding, and they have been, again, over the last year, able to hold outright territories in the Borno province of Nigeria. They're also making incursions into Cameroon, very often based on somewhat ethnic ties. It's not that there's one ethnicity in Borno supporting Boko Haram. It's rather that they use these connections to promote some of their operations and get some kind of local support rather than outright ideological support. So rather contacts that are not necessarily convinced about ideology of the form of Islamic State in West Africa, the former Boko Haram. We can also see that the group that broke away from Boko Haram, the old Shekau group, still exists, and it's still going relatively strong, and it's still in control of some of its former areas, and it's still a valid organization to count with. And this is even after now 2 or 3 months of offensives against it. So basically, these the two organizations that have emerged from Boko Haram are still fit for fight, and they are doing relatively well, and actually extremely well in if you compare it to the pressure that is put on them. If you go further north, you will talk about the Jabhat Nusra in Mali. In one sense, the focus in Mali has changed a little bit from the northern part of Mali, which still have intensive jihadist activities, so intensive that you can go 5 or 6 kilometers outside of Timbuktu and you can run into checkpoints from some of these organizations from Jabhat. But what we see now is a kind of tense situation in the middle part of Mali, the Mopti region, and we've seen that over the last year. The question is what really happens there. It's hard to say because it's obviously a conflict between nomads and the sedentary population, but the question is if the jihadists can tap into that conflict and expand in the area. And there are some signs that they might do that, but the situation is not entirely clear. We also see some of these groups expanding into Burkina Faso. And before we started this talk, I was asked about potential hotspots to watch in the future, and I think Burkina Faso is one of these hotspots. Again, they are drawing on specific local conflicts, sometimes between the local population in Burkina Faso and the center of the country, so it's a kind of center-periphery conflict, but there are a potential there for some kind of expansion. I do think these local factors that interfere in the process, I do think that they hamper fast expansions further south. So we still have some time before we see a step further south from these groups. But for Burkina Faso, it's actually important to try to deal with the new security problems. And Niger is another hotspot where you see some signs that it might get worse in the future. And that's actually in where you have this Islamic State in the Greater Sahara, a very pragmatic Islamic State province, relatively weak, but also with the potential for some activities within in Niger. If you step to Congo, the situation in Congo is also very interesting, where you've seen since 2017 that some of the groups may be previously a part of the Allied Democratic Forces, which is basically a very weird organization that I think also you encountered at times at previous stages, that started out as a union between basically what was really an Islamist organization and a non-Islamist local resistant organization in the 90s, but that has been predicted to die off for more than 25 years, but still are around. What we have seen for the three last years is videos surfacing from Congo taking responsibilities for attack in the name of the Islamic State. We've seen a Kenyan court case involving persons linked both to the Islamic State and parts of the ADF. We also seen a lot of experts that say that the ADF is seriously weakened, and it's highlighted that some of the attacks that the ADF might have implemented in Congo might have been implemented by other actors. So information about the ADF and the potential transition from of the ADF into the Islamic State sphere is hard to combine. But there have been something going on there, that's quite sure, because you can see it in the media activity and you can see it also in the court cases that are going on in Kenya. So this is also, in fact, a place to watch, but it's a kind of joker. It can switch both ways. It's very interesting for me that if you go to the recent activities in northern Mozambique, it seems rather to gravitate towards Congo, rather to gravitate to north, towards the north of the coast, where you have some clear connections with individuals operating in Congo. There are some connections in Mozambique further north into Somalia also as well. But that's another hotspot that we should watch. It's Mozambique, basically, northern Mozambique. And if you go up the coast, the news becomes a little bit better. Because despite the Dusit attack in Kenya, If you look into the details of the Dusit attack by the Shebab in Kenya, you can see that the security services are handling the situation better. And Tanzania has faced some really nasty predictions in the past, but the patterns of Tanzania, they had jihadist activities, they had Shebab activities inside the country, but it seems to go in waves. So there's networks created that commits violence, and then the Tanzanian security services are good at striking down upon them. They will disappear, and for now it seems like these networks are very weakened. But they resurfaced in the past. So it's a kind of ongoing process where you have to watch how Tanzania performs. It's interesting for me that if you look at the Tanzanian pattern so far, a lot of the experts were highlighting the Zanzibar situation and basically the Zanzibari resistance towards some of the mainland political movements as a very important trigger. But ladies and gentlemen, most of the activities that you can see from Tanzania in the past have been ongoing in the mainland. So that's also a surprise for several experts, I think. It's a lot of things to be said about the Kenyan way to handle its Shebab offshoots, but for now it seems like the Kenyans are kind of better situated than in the past. The intelligence services are operating better. They learn to deal with the Somali community in a different way than they did 7 years ago. But it's still also an ongoing battle for the Kenyans, and the Dusit attack shows that the Shebab will be able to at least penetrate sometimes the security inside Kenya. But it seems that the Kenyans are more on top of things than they were before. It seems like they have managed to take and deal with a lot of returning foreign fighters from Somalia. And it seems like they also have been dealing with the recruitment. When I do field research in Kenya, I can see that there's still a recruitment potential. There's still cells that have very extreme opinions, but it's harder for them to connect, for example, to the Shebab and connect with outsiders. So still Kenya should be watched. If we then go to Ethiopia is an interesting country to watch. It's also something that should be on a watch list, because the Ethiopian intelligence and Ethiopian security services have in the past actually been very good. But what we see now is a period of transition. And I wonder if this period of transition will hurt Ethiopian capacities in order their capacities to actually stop Shebab infiltrating the country and stopping Shebab attempting to stage attack in that country. Because the Shebab have tried that many times in the past. So some media would say that there's a renewed interest in Ethiopia from the Shebab side. I would say that this is not a renewed interest, because it's been there since 2007. I've seen several plots in the past. But Ethiopia is a bit in a weakened state today, and that makes me want to watch that. The last organization is, of course, the Shebab in Somalia. And there's a lot of strange things coming out from Somalia as well when it comes to news, two positive news from the government. I would say Shebab is today, ladies and gentlemen, an astonishingly rich organization. They're highly successful in taxing internally. The drone strikes from the United States have taken its toll. It hurts Shebab in many strange ways. One of the ways that it hurts Shebab is that the Shebab Sharia courts outside of Mogadishu, they were actually quite popular inside Mogadishu, but now it's seen as more dangerous to try to draw upon their services, because the Sharia courts of the Shebab were much more efficient in handling property conflicts. So the Shebab are facing battlefield challenges. They are facing... they have nervous leaders that are facing all the time the threats from being killed of the drone strikes by United States. But they also have access to waste amounts of money, because they are able to tax regardless what the government says, the Somali governments tell us. They are able to tax the whole of Mogadishu and are quite good at doing this in the countryside as well. In fact, I would say, after my field research in Somalia, I would say that they are better to tax Mogadishu than the government. So it's a rich organization facing some strains, but not, in fact, losing a lot of territories anymore. So I would say it's a rich and stable organization.
Fantastic overview. I think you mentioned about a dozen countries, mostly in West Africa, coming around the bend with Nigeria, Cameroon, dipping into Congo, and then coming up the East Coast. And I think you covered probably slightly more than half of sub-Saharan Africa's population, because you mentioned Ethiopia, Nigeria, Kenya, Tanzania, I think four of the five largest in population, four of the six largest. So we've got a lot to talk about. Before we start to bear down on a few specifics, let me ask one more big picture question just to sort of aggregate a lot of the information you just put on the table. When I think in historical terms of trends with jihadism in Africa, I think of big problems in Algeria 20 years ago. I think of Boko Haram, of course, with its takeover of areas in Nigeria half a decade ago or so, a little more. I think of the big problem in Mali that the French intervened around 2013 to deal with, which has reemerged, as you described. I think, of course, of al-Shabaab in Somalia and everything from Black Hawk down to the 25 years since. But most of these big news flashes are at least somewhat distant in the past now. Mm. And what you're doing is reminding us not to let down our guard. But is it wrong to conclude that as much as jihadism is still a problem in many places, that at least there's sort of a cap on the general pervasiveness and severity of the problem across the continent? It's not getting a whole lot worse writ large. It may be getting worse here or there, but it may be getting a little bit less severe in other places. And on balance, it's more or less at a plateau. Is that a fair conclusion or not?
I think it's a rather fair conclusion. It's stable, but it's potentially also problematic for us, although it's stable. First and foremost, several of these actors, I'm not saying that it's going to be likely that we see a Boko Haram or a JNIM or Shabab attacks in the West. It's actually highly unlikely. But what we see is that they do target the West in their propaganda. What we see is that they have an eagerness to target Western targets on the ground in Africa. And the West, after all, has a lot of investment in some of these countries. In Amenas, attack really shows how vulnerable we can be on the ground for such attacks. And the last factor here is some kind of mutations that we should be aware and follow these organizations, because it might be that there are some changes that leads them to focus more internationally. So they should be watched in relation to the Shabab, for example. There are some positive traits. You know, all the Afghanistan veterans that were a part of that organization at the start, they actually died out. They are either captured or killed by United States, or in some cases even killed by local clans. So there is a new leadership. But on the other side, you know, it seems like Islamic State had, until the recent killing of Baghdadi, a much stronger influence on the remains of Boko Haram than a lot of people expected, you know, to the extent that they could standardize propaganda. And to the extent that that one of these factions actually seemed genuinely loyal to the central organization of the Islamic State. So there is some kind of increasing international links. And I see, you know, you could also see ways that these organizations can influence the international jihadi agenda and the international discussions. And for me, specializing on Africa, it was interesting to see Boko Haram's and Shabab's role in the rivalry between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And they had the global role because they were used for the propaganda purposes. Mm. So the Islamic State tried to switch Shabab away from Al-Qaeda. And in that process, they were using Boko Haram propaganda-wise. So Boko Haram would make propaganda videos saying that Shabab should change their affiliations. And of course, Shabab was very important propaganda-wise for Al-Qaeda, because it was the second numerically strongest organization that stayed with them. So and they held territories, and they do still hold territories, in fact. And so that there are ways that they play into the international jihadist sphere. There are threats against us, but it's not, the threats doesn't manifest themselves in Shabab planning an attack against the West, or in the Islamic State in West Africa planning an attack in the West.
So let me ask, I want to come back to where you have your greatest worries and greatest concerns, but I also want to put on the table any kind of good news you might have for us. I mean, one bit of good news might be that at least the threat's not getting dramatically worse continent-wide, as we just discussed. But I wondered if there were any success stories. You mentioned Kenya's police doing a better job, for example. I wondered if there are any case studies that you would point to, either in terms of how African countries can learn from each other, or how we could potentially support the right kinds of policies as Western partners, donors, trainers, what have you. So any particular pilot projects or case studies or success stories that you'd want to emphasize?
No, I want to highlight, but there's prices to be paid for that. You know, the largest success story so far is actually Tanzania. You know, they do get the waves, but they do manage to strike down on them. And Kenya, as you said, also have actually been improving. The thing is that in Kenya, there's a soft side to the countermeasures and there's a hard side. So the intelligence capacities of Kenya, the security capacities of Kenya has been improving on the soft side, on drawing people to become more loyal towards the state. I don't think the improvement has been that drastic. So you still have some kind of recruitment potential. But we can look to Tanzania. And there's all the good news, but it's good news that is rather because of us misunderstanding some of these organizations. We often think about these organizations as a kind of balloon that they lose in the battlefield and you push them into other places. And you can see that in the past when people were saying that the Sheba was going to evacuate to the north in Somalia. You can see today, ladies and gentlemen, when they say that the Burkina Faso activities means that you will see a Jenin push towards the coast. The thing, ladies and gentlemen, that are good news to us is that the local dynamics are so strong in some of these organizations and the way that they tap into local grievances. So it's not easy for them to move from location to location. They move, but then they move rather slowly with local partners, so it takes time for them to expand and move their area of attention. And that's rather good news, but it's not because of what, it's rather because of some of the interaction between these organizations and local ethnic groups and local grievances, basically.
By the way, before I forget to ask, you mentioned that some of these groups target Western interests. We know some of the hotel attacks in West Africa, some other tragedies. Have they been attacking Chinese interests? There's a lot of talk about China's greater role in Africa, greater investments. I wondered if they've managed to avoid being seen as an important target or if that's beginning.
So far, China is doing relatively well. I do think that China has a threat against them. You can see, for example, that they do a lot of support for some of the oil industry in eastern Ethiopia, and that means that they are tempting attacks for the Sheba because they want to hurt the Ethiopian economy. So there's not a manifestation of direct threat yet, but there is potential there for the Chinese, and I know that they care about this. They've been thinking about this. In fact, they were very eager in translating my latest book, so yeah.
Interesting. That tells you a lot right there. Let me ask about, I'm just going to ask one more broad question and then look forward to your thoughts and questions as well for the time we've got until about 11:30. I wanted to ask if there's any place, you already surveyed the continent very nicely and you already began to hint at the answer perhaps to my question, but any place you would really call our attention to where a threat is developing, becoming more severe, or the way it intermixes with local politics, other grievances, certain kinds of internal tensions could really be explosive, even if the jihadism element itself is perhaps only a piece of that country's problems. For example, you already alluded to how Ethiopia, which is one of Africa's great success stories these days, at least we hope, and we've seen progress in recent years, but of course it's a fragile progress, and there are a lot of internal tensions. You mentioned the way in which jihadism could intersect with, overlap with, contribute to a combustible mix.
Yeah.
Is there any other place, or maybe you want to talk more about Ethiopia, but any place where you really want to call our attention and say this is not getting enough focused concern and perhaps resources or new policy initiatives?
The thing is, if there's a nucleus of some kind of jihadist networks in the country and you have a state breakdown or a heavy civil war, that can heavily lead to some kind of jihadist expansion, and it has done in the past. That's one of the reasons that they were so successful in Somalia. And, of course, 2013 was a big success also, at least at the start, at the end of 2012 and 2013, was a big success for the jihadists in Mali as well, partly because of this. So we need to watch war zones, and we actually need to think about stability. And as you said, Ethiopia is important to watch. There's also another type of threat that we need to watch, and that's where it's actually spreading. We don't know exactly the nature of those organizations yet, but Mozambique should be a place where the United States should watch very closely. and Burkina Faso should be a place where the United States should watch really closely. And it's also rather important to think about handling the conflicts of central Mali, basically the Mopti region. And that's mundane things. It's basically trying to handle the conflicts between the pastoral population and the farmers, because you might see JNIM entrepreneurs trying to take over that conflict. And I said I was wrong when I said you've seen already such entrepreneurs working. So that's places to watch.
One last question. I don't think you've touched on Sudan, or at least not much. And I wonder why not, because 10 and 15 years ago, we saw the Janjaweed, and I thought there were sort of ethnic and also religious elements in some of the internal and terrible strife that we saw in Sudan, especially 10 to 20 years ago. But you haven't emphasized that today. Is that just a different type of problem? You don't capture under the term jihadism, or is it just calmer and better with the split of the two Sudans? How do you see that situation?
Historically, Sudan has been amazingly important for African jihadism, and it was like the core of the networks that were created in the 90s that were very important, also for Shabab, in fact.
Yeah.
For the Kenyan jihadist networks, maybe for the ADF. You know, the primary sources are pointing in different directions, Eritrean Islamic Jihad. And of course it hosted Osama bin Laden. It doesn't seem to have the importance to that extent today, but it's also a place to watch for the future. I think Sudan gives a very important reminder to us, and it's very, very important, because if you look into Al-Qaeda's history in Sudan, it's easy for us to think about September 11th, to think about Al-Qaeda as an independent actor for Sudan. But the thing, if you study Al-Qaeda's actions inside Sudan, they were more or less operating as one out of many foreign policy tools of Sudan. Where the Sudanese fought wars, Al-Qaeda very often went. So Sudan's allies in Eritrea, Eritrean Islamic Jihad, we have testimonies from the 9/11 court cases that they were there, they were supporting them. And of course, Shebab is predecessor of Shebab, Al-Ittihad al-Islamiyya. That's also, we have very clear testimonies that they were there. And my main point, ladies and gentlemen, is that some of these organizations we talk about here have been used by local leaders for governance purposes and for foreign policy tools, and have been accepted. They had an accepted presence. We talk about Boko Haram now as being illegal. You know what? From 2003 until 2009, they were legal. They had their conflicts with the state, but they were legal. They were a legal organization. If you talk about Ansar Dine and even to a certain extent AKIM, basically some of the member organizations in JNIM in the past, you can see that they have been used in the power place between Mali and Algeria. And for now, this is a little bit out of the questions that this might happen, because United States, you showed your muscles. You don't accept that type of behavior, nor do the European unions. And I don't think even China is not too happy about that behavior. But we can reach a stage in the future where you actually lose the attention to those phenomena, where United States' attention is more strongly focused on China, and maybe China's attention is focused on the United States, and maybe the EU's attention is focused on themselves. And then you might see such a scenario again, where you had the jihadists gaining legitimacy by being used by local power fractions. And that's also something to watch. This is a little bit further into the future, but it's something that we should keep in mind, because historically it was a phenomena. It's not a strong phenomena today, but it was a phenomena, and it might reemerge in the future.
Great. So let's go to your questions. And again, I'm going to do the second of my three advertisements for the book. As you can tell, we're talking about all of Africa, Horn, Sahel, and Rift. Horn of Africa, this broader Sahel region, the Rift Valley, and even East Africa down further towards Mozambique. So the whole continent is Stieg's oyster, and we look forward to questions starting in the very back, my friend.
Good morning. My name is Scott Morgan. I'm a freelance security analyst covering African issues. I have a quick four-part question. First, country that would be considered a success story. How about Chad? Second part, I haven't heard anything regarding the Central African Republic. Third part is specifically for Michael about the reemergence of the ADF over the last few months with their brazen attacks around Beni. And the last part is, regarding Mozambique, we're starting to see attacks on Russian interests in Mozambique as well. I was wondering if you could comment on all of those. Thank you.
Over to you, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be tempted to add somebody else, but I think with a four-parter, we'll go.
Yeah, very
straight to the answer.
Very good questions. If Chad is a success story, it remains yet to be seen, because what we've seen is that we saw Chad saving, I would say, more or less saving the situation in Borno. But you know what? I followed Boko Haram over time, and I saw the predictions of their downfall in 2009 after they were banned. I saw their predictions of the downfall in 2013 after the Nigerians created a new division to handle them. I saw the predictions of their downfall after the offensives in 2016. And you know what it seems now? It seems like Boko Haram, or rather the Islamic State of West Africa, they have methods to deal with them. You know, no, the Chadians are not making that much difference. But the Chadians are good allies of the United States, and they do have some battle worth that the other parties don't have. But I do see that the Islamic State in West Africa have managed to deal with them. Yeah? And the Central African Republic, so far, you know, it's an also a very interesting question, because you've seen both Islamic State in Western Africa and Shebab propaganda about the Central African Republic. You've seen they have been interested. There have been also rumors about some kind of connections, but you don't see the large-scale manifestations yet. But maybe there's also a place to watch. And, you know, I'm very interested in discussing ADF as well, but maybe you can start with discussing it. Russian interests in Mozambique? Russia is re-emerging as an African actor, and it's re-emerging partly, ladies and gentlemen, because if you get Russian support, you know that they will be there for you. And that's another issue with both China and United States these days. You don't know to the extent that United States commitment is a full commitment, and China is very often economic commitment. They do have military advisors, I admit that, but not of the size that makes it strategical. I would like to comment on the ADF as well, but maybe you should start.
Start, and then I'll add a word. Go ahead.
I think ADF has been underestimated again. I do think that we are not rid of ADF. There's a lot of conspiracies locally, and I don't believe any of those conspiracies. But I think they have been continuously underestimated, and I don't think we've seen the last of the ADF. They are situated there, and they also seemingly have networks inside Uganda that maybe are deeper than we think they are.
So the only point I would add, and I'm sure, Scott, you know this at least as well as I do, but of course, it's hard to think of the Congolese population providing a particularly fertile recruiting base for a jihadist organization given ethnic and religious history. On the other hand, the state is so weak, the security forces are so weak, and there is enough spillover from Central and East Africa with some of the group connections that I think one could imagine, localized problems. And anything that's localized in Congo risks spreading because the state doesn't have the capacity to really contain it. So I guess that's a good news, bad news. I don't really see Congo's 80 million people as being likely to be swayed by an extremist ideology, particularly not an Islamist one. But on the other hand, the state is still so weak that it's hard for me to know what it could actually deal with and contain. This is the country, after all, where, as you well know, 20-some years ago, a local leader managed to essentially march 1,000 miles west through jungle and rainforest and overthrow a government. And Congo's a little more stable today than it was at the end of the Mobutu reign, but still, of course, not very good. And therefore, I share the concern.
Yeah, I would highlight that I do agree with what you were saying at the start. You know, when I say that ADF has been underestimated, I don't see ADF as the big game changer in Congo. But I do take into account the many predictions of their downfall. And I don't see that downfall coming up as of yet. And I think one important factor with the ADF that it's easy to forget is that it was a part of the government system from 96 to 98. And at that stage, they were encouraged to invest into the local business sector, and those investments are not fully stalled yet. So they were rather integrated into the local community at the time, and I think that helped them to survive. And you have these rumors that we talked about. So you probably both of you are aware that last summer you had killings of several sheikhs in Kampala. You had the Ugandan security services saying that this was the ADF actually operating within Kampala. It's rather hard to really say what that was. At the time, I had several conversations with the Ugandan intelligence officials, and they would say that it was the ADF, but they will also say explicitly that ADF was not a major threat against Uganda, which is a kind of a strange balance that makes you wonder a little bit about some of these assessments. But it seems like they have some kind of networks going both south and also east, at least. Yeah.
Thank you. Another question. We'll move up here closer to the front. We'll start with the woman in the third row, please. And then we'll go back to the gentleman in the 10th row after that. Please identify yourself if you could.
Glasheva Security European Union Delegation. The Americans keep listing Sudan.
We can't hear you.
In the Americans have Sudan under the SSD list, and in our discussions with them, they are telling us that there are a lot of conditions to be fulfilled in order for the country to be delisted, despite the fact that if it gets delisted, they will benefit from debt relief or funding from the
closer international, your mouth. I can't hear you.
International financial institutions and so on. My question to you is the following. Do the Americans have reasons to use the argument that Sudan is not cooperating sufficiently in the effort of counterterrorism, therefore they should remain on the list? This is one of their conditions.
Yeah, I think also an excellent question. And I think there's reasons for suspicions given the fact that they were so heavily integrated to the jihadist scene in Africa. But we need more research on the issue. That's my question, and it's going to be a very open question, but that's also reflecting, I think, what the state of the knowledge amongst the research community on these issues are. So it needs to have more research on it, and that's hard because Sudan is not really an easy country to do research in, even not now it's easy.
Although if I could just follow up quickly, it sounds like your instinct is to say that Sudan is not particularly active these days in any kind of state sponsorship of terrorism. So if it's a question of, like, what have you done for me lately or what have you done against me lately, probably Sudan should be reassessed and perhaps not be on the list in the same way that, you know, a Pakistan could arguably be put there or certainly an Iran. It doesn't sound like it's in that same category of activity. Is that fair?
No, it's not on the same category when it comes to activity, but it might be parts of the state that are close to these groups still, yeah. And that might be of U.S. interest and European interest as well.
Yeah. Okay, we'll go to the gentleman in the back, please.
Good morning. My name is Pa, working with the Gambian Embassy. My question is related to Boko Haram. Could coercion, the use of force, be a good strategy in dealing with Boko Haram? If yes, what could be the strength and weakness of the use of coercion in dealing with Boko Haram? Thank you.
I should stop saying that, but that's also a brilliant question. and you know what? That gives me the chance to highlight one of the big mistakes that the West and also several African countries have done in Africa. And also one of the issues going on in my book, I have something that I have a state of affairs that's called semi-territoriality, where basically these organizations are left in control of the countryside. And you can have armies like the Nigerian armies and its allies in Borno, but also like the Somali army and African Union forces in Somalia that really have a superiority when it comes to fighting open battles. But because of strategic reasons, also because of force protection reasons, because of economic reasons, they concentrate themselves in super camps, which is kind of important for Nigeria now. And I saw this, and my heart really bleeds when I hear that strategy. And what does that mean? It means that the countryside is left on the whim to the jihadists. And ladies and gentlemen, if we don't ensure the protection for the locals in the countryside, ADF will be the future of African jihadists. What do I mean by that? None of them are going to disappear. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been fighting this battle since 2006, 2005. Not a single organization has disappeared. So there's been no strategic victories whatsoever in Africa. Some good examples, but no strategic victories. And I think part of that is because you underestimate the rural dynamics. We tend to read in the papers about the big attacks in sometimes in Abuja, sometimes in Mogadishu, sometimes in Nairobi. Sometimes the dynamics that is really important is to which extent these organizations manage to tax the countryside, to which extent they manage to go into a village and take a camel or a pig in West Africa. And this is often forgotten, that you have this local taxing, and as long as the local population is left alone for various reasons, it's not going to change. And you know what's happening now in Somalia? You have an offensive in Lower Shabelle. The Somali army are going in, capturing villages, and then they are withdrawing. What a rubbish strategy. You know, that leaves the villages on the whims of the Shabab. It doesn't matter anything. It doesn't create any change. It just creates some kind of highlights in international media saying that we conquered this village. For the villages, that means that they will have Shabab back next week. And who did they have to deal with? The Shabab. How do you deal with it? You provide them recruits. You provide them money. You provide them sometimes even wives. And then you become more integrated into them. You have to do that because you have to face them in a day-to-day situation. I think that aspect of policy has been a disaster. It has been a disaster all across Africa, and it's one of the reasons that the ADF still exists. And the ADF is kind of the modern example of this because it has been predicted to die so many times. You know, since 1996, everybody was talking about it. They're going to die, they're going to diminish, they're going to disappear. But they're still here, and maybe they are getting stronger. So that's a dire prediction. And I wonder if we are able institutionally, both the West and also several of the African countries, to deal with these problems in a proper way, because it doesn't give the big headlines. You know, to protect the local villagers doesn't give the big headlines, and it's resource-consuming. So it's maybe not an attention-grabber, but I do think it's very essential if you want to challenge these organizations. Furthermore, I think it might be essential also outside of the African context. So this is, for me, a big problem in counter-terrorist strategy and counter-jihadist strategy of the West and also some of the countries around the world, including several of the African countries.
You know, if I could add 2 points before we go to the next question, just from my experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is somewhat different but somewhat analogous in certain ways. The first point is doesn't disagree with anything you just said, but is sort of at some tension with it. The second point completely reaffirms what you said. The first point is that if you look historically at our experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, in Iraq we did try eventually, with the Iraqi forces, of course, to get out into most smaller cities and towns and villages and provide protection. But in Afghanistan, where there's never been the same ratio of troops and police to the population, we've actually been trying to persuade the Afghan security forces to pull back from some of the more remote locations, because otherwise they provide tempting targets for the Taliban, because the number one threat in many ways to the success of the Afghan enterprise has been casualties to the security forces. And so in light of the fact that the Taliban is strong and quite well entrenched in certain parts of the country, there really aren't enough Afghan and NATO forces to patrol everywhere. In that case, we've tried to encourage them to pull back into a smaller number of fortifications. But that's really a question about the specifics of Afghanistan. It has to do with the strength of the enemy, the size of the security forces. That's why I say I don't think it disagrees with anything that you just said. Just sometimes you wind up with a different conclusion based on local circumstances. My second point, where I totally agree with you, is this concept that, of course, in some ways is just good old-fashioned counterinsurgency thinking and doctrine, but we developed new slogans and new ways of talking about it in Iraq and Afghanistan. The expression clear, hold, build, transfer. If we couldn't do all four of those things, clear the enemy, build up local successes, clear the enemy, hold on to that territory, help the Iraqi or Afghanistan government build up capacity to govern there, and then transfer full responsibility to them. If we couldn't do all four of those things, it was better not to do any of them. It was better not to go in and do the raid and then withdraw. because you were just leaving people vulnerable. You were dismantling structures that may have been partly successful that the Taliban provided, and thereby creating more resentment against your efforts. And you certainly weren't achieving any net harm to the enemy. So I just wanted to add those points as well.
Yes, I would like to also maybe we shouldn't just a short comment on Afghanistan.
Please.
You know, when you pull out of territories like that, you basically leave it open, and that's what's happened. You know, let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, there is another winner in Afghanistan, and that's not us. You know, it's basically Taliban who has been on the increase as of lately because we so much territory was yielded to them. And that's also something that still can happen in Africa, you know. Yeah.
Okay, another question. We'll go to my friend here in the hat in the fifth row. Is that you wearing a Michigan hat today? No, it's not Michigan. Anyway, I can't read it from here, but you know who I, you know. Tell us what your hat's about, though. I'm curious now.
It's not enigma.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much for a great presentation, Mr. Manson.
Please identify yourself for everybody else's benefit.
I'm Elliot Hurwitz.
I wanted to ask about the possible export of ISIS activities outside the continent.
Outside the continent of Africa?
From Africa to
the West.
To the rest of the world.
Yeah. There are some interesting trades that has been ongoing for the two last years. And if you look into, for example, the recruitment, I think Shebab had more global recruitment than, for example, the Islamic State in West Africa and also JNA. They did manage to recruit, although a lot of ethnic Somalis, they did manage to recruit heavily in Minnesota. They did manage to recruit heavily in Scandinavia. And the Shebab recruitment efforts, to a certain extent, stopped when they were outcompeted by the Islamic State in the Levant. What we see now is that there are small signs of some of these communities recruiting to Islamic State again in East Africa. It's very small signs. It's still just a small, several court cases, less than five around the world, but it's something to watch. If you think about the Islamic State affiliates in Africa hitting outside of Africa, we have to remember their size. So we have the Islamic State in Somalia. They have some activities around Afgoya, you know, the nature of those activities, as we spoke about in the office, is not very clear. Their strength is in Puntland, and the strength they have in Puntland is because, you know, the mountains there are hard to really secure. And secondly, Shebab, this main strength of the Shebab is rather far away. And it's not a heavy international potential for that group in Puntland. It's not that strong, and it's farther away from the targets. And if you look into another Islamic State affiliates, you have the Islamic State in Greater Sahara, basically the most pragmatic of the lot. You know, they were beaten very heavily by JNIM affiliates at the start, and after that they started to be accommodating towards JNIM. So they accommodated basically the local Al-Qaeda affiliates, and they are heavily integrated into the local economy to the extent of you wonder what this really is. So locally around Menaka, they will call them literally the cattle rustlers of Menaka. That's a nickname they have at the local level. And that's all they feed themselves, basically, also. So that's also very localized and minor. So the big, there's a question mark in Africa, and that is what's going on in Congo. But it's decentralized. The Congo situation is so decentralized. And given the discussions about the ADF, I was talking about the ADF surviving. We don't know which part of ADF who is tilting towards the Islamic State. It might be large parts of the organization. It just might be sub-parts of the organization. And we do know that the ADF for now has enough problems with just surviving. So it's not a big potential there for the near future, but it might have some potential to spread into other areas in Africa. And the biggest, most important Al-Qaeda affiliates in Africa is actually the Islamic State in West Africa, the largest part of the former Boko Haram. And the Shekau part of the Boko Haram is still not distanced itself from the Islamic State either, but they haven't been fully accepted by the Islamic State. But the thing is also when it comes to the modus operandi of the Boko Haram in the past, it has been very localized in its focus. So I don't see the large threat outside of Africa from any of these organizations. I do think that we will see Islamic State in West Africa participating in the global propaganda war of the Islamic State, definitively. I do think that we will see the Puntlanders inside the Islamic State in Somalia interacting with Yemen to a large extent. But the Islamic State in Yemen also has its problems. So it's like two weak guys trying to help each other, which is not really that efficient all the time. So I don't see this big potential for expansions outside of the continent of these organizations.
Just one footnote as I go to the next question. The book is Horn, Sahel, and Rift, and we're talking primarily about sub-Saharan Africa, but it's worth noting, Elliot, that, of course, if we look at Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, you've had some of the most fertile recruiting pools for ISIS in the Levant and for al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia in earlier days. So that interaction has been well established, even though we're talking today primarily about sub-Saharan Africa.
Very important clarification.
So let's go to the gentleman in the far back, and then we'll come back to the front.
Thank you. Hashim here, Institute of World Politics. Well, thanks for clarifying that it's not the entire continent of Africa. I started feeling like there's many speakers using the word Africa a lot, and I think it's important that you clarify that it's a specific country because Africa is over 1 billion people. Anyway, my question is, with this bleak jihadism and stories, any opportunities for mutual development, trades, or any foreign policy that is more geared toward development and the opportunity since Russia and Chinese are also taking advantage of that? Thank you.
Any policies geared towards, you mean in relations to counter-terrorism and counter-jihadism, or can you elaborate a little bit?
No. Just development by way of uprooting these activities. If you think that jihadism in any of this part of the continent, if the reason is poverty or any of lack of development, what do you propose? Thank you.
I think definitively that low income contributes to recruitment in most of these cases. I do think that if you want to do development, firstly, it's a harder business than you might expect because you have been attempting to do this quite a long time, you know, since you had the famous speech in 1948. It has been agenda. So this is a long-term strategy. That's very important. So you need to hedge against something else in the short run. I also do think that even though you have some development, you will have these force structures, organizations that use coercion to survive, so they might have a potential even though you do have some kind of development. But development is needed to curtail some of the recruitment potential. But we shouldn't remember that you have an agency there. You have actually an agency by these organizations that are trying to recruit locally and will force people to obey them. They will have resources to force people to obey them. Also, people with middle income in an African context. So you have that on top. But development is important, but it's a long-term strategy.
Go to the woman here in the white scarf in the fifth row, please, on the aisle.
Again, to know your assessment about the possibilities for spread of jihadism in Western Sahara, given the refusal, the Moroccan refusal to negotiate self-determination with the Polisario Front.
Morocco.
I used to say Polisario. I think also I should stop saying that, but that's a very good question. And you know what the interesting thing, if you go and look back to the origins of the Islamic State in Western Sahara, they can be traced back to individuals living in Sahrawi refugee camps. So you have actually a straight line going back to Western Sahara, but it seems like they have been jumping off from the Western Sahara focus and rather move their focus southwards. But they are a product including their current leader, al-Sarawi, of course, al-Sarawi. He is a product of the Western Saharan conflict, and that's also very important in order to understand that organization, the start of that organization. Ethnically, it changed a little bit now, but it's very important. So it's an important thing to watch, and it has already had effects on parts of the jihadi scene in the sub-Saharan Africa. Yeah.
The gentleman here in the third row, please. The yellow shirt.
Thank you, Neil Boyer, Peace Corps. You had mentioned, you know, the localized dynamics, and I want to look at the issue of Mali and Burkina, particularly in terms of the ethnic dynamics between pastoralists and sedentarists in the context of climate change, focusing on the dynamic between the Fulani in Burkina, and in so much as you have a large ethnic dynamic, climate change dynamic also in Mali. What are the implications for countries with large Fulani populations such as Guinea, to a certain degree Gambia, et cetera, in terms of spreading eastward?
Yeah, the thing is that we talk about the Fulanis, but their grievances vary a little bit from country to country. So if you go to the Mopti region, you have problems with the Dogonis, which is something to do with a lot of different things. You know, climate change might be a factor. Another change might be the another change that are important is might be the change of the river courses, and also actually the change of some crops that has been growing in the area. There's a new type of crop coming in, and that creates some extra challenges. So it's quite mundane, and that's a kind of local dynamics that is hard to transfer for other Fulanis outside of there. And the same thing goes for Burkina Faso to a certain extent, where you have this center-periphery tension. And that makes it, you cannot say that a Fulani is a blank check for having some kind of jihadist thing going on. You have to look into the local grievances. But you know what, on the top of these local grievances, you need some kind of successful entrepreneurship on behalf of some of the jihadists. So you need those two combinations. So that means that you need for Fulanis in other parts of West Africa, you need some kind of local grievances and local conflicts that are there, and you need some kind of network connections going back perhaps to 2012, 2013, and the territories that was cleared by the Northern Mali jihadists, and that's what you see in Burkina Faso, that's what you see in the Mopti region. So you need those constellations to emerge, and that might take time. Maybe you need new networks, so it will maybe spread rather more slowly than people expect it to be. So I'm not an alarmist on this. It might spread, but it will take time, and we will have ample time to see it, see the tendencies towards spreading. Yeah.
So let's take two more questions together as our last round, and then we'll have you wrap up if we could. We'll take the question, the woman in the sort of maroon shirt in the very back, and then we'll come right up here to the gentleman in the black shirt in the fourth row. Please.
Yes, good morning. Lakeisha Harrison. A very simple but loaded question, perhaps. Where does AFRICOM sit in the midst of all of this?
Good question, and then thank you up here to the fourth row. We'll take these together if we could, and then wrap up.
Thank you. It's to come back to the question that was earlier asked. My name's Charles. I represent Lafayette Praetorian. We're a security and logistics group, very well implanted in the Sahel, Niamey, Bamako, Ouagadougou, in the region. What do you say to the notion that these actors are essentially socioeconomic actors more than anything else, and that ideology is not really the problem or main recruitment tool or reason to spread, but rather economic growth and opportunity, or rather lack thereof, especially when it comes to the local youth? And the reason I ask this is because we're very close with tribal leaders in the region, in the Sahel, and we know that they allow some of their members to go and work for the West one day, work for an armed group the next day, work for the jihadist, and at the end of the day, it's just a way to make a buck.
Yep. Okay, I will start with the last question first. It's a complex and very important question. So the first issue is reflecting on your question previously. You know, do so economic factors like poverty and deprivation create these jihadist groups? What we see is that when you talk to the recruits, they will talk about economic factors definitively. And this is also dependent on what kind of situation the jihadist group is in. If they control territory, if they control what I call semi-territoriality, kind of control, kind of presence in the villages that are neglected, they will be efficient payer of bread day to day. So there might be economic opportunities going into them. So that's an important factor, but the thing is we have to look into the networks to explain why these organizations occur, when they occur. You know, why did these turn into jihadists rather than to Marxists? They did that in the past, but they don't do anymore. And we also need to have the jihadist networks in mind, because you need entrepreneurs to take care and handle these conflicts, to take advantage of it. And at times, not often, we have seen strategic support. So we know, because of the Timbuktu papers, that in a crucial period of Boko Haram's life, they got help from Akim. Not a lot, 100,000 euros, I think, 100 or 200,000, I cannot really remember now. But at that stage, in the early Boko Haram history, it was crucial. Although small, it was crucial. So we need to have these, take these dynamics into consideration as well. So, you know, it's a kind of mix. And maybe the tendencies amongst Africanist studies today is to focus on these local factors. You know, talk about poverty. And the local factors are very important, but we need to have these networks, take these networks into consideration as well. And in one sense, I read your questions a little bit divided into two. Because you can talk about these economic factors, but you can also talk about social groups. And another thing that maybe we could be better at, both in the European Union and in the United States, is to recognize the alternative social actors, like the tribes. And I've seen so many tribes and ethnic groupings with a traditional leadership trying to play both the jihadists and the government, you know, in an amazing way. And they try to co-opt the local jihadists by supplying recruits, take over the local chapters, but at the same time they will sit in the parliament. And the thing is, you have an interaction. There's an interaction between the three sides. Sometimes there's gray zones, but there are also clear policy formulations by the jihadists, relatively clear policy formulations on behalf of some of these tribal groupings that we are not aware of, and some kind of state policy formulations as well. So you have to be aware of those gray zones. That also means that tribal dynamics and tribal conflicts is very important for jihadist recruitment. And that's one of the reasons that you cannot move them along. That's one of the reasons that the balloon hypothesis, well, if you squeeze the balloon in Africa, the balloon will move very slowly, because you cannot remove yourself out of the local dynamics and flow into another area without actually preparations, without establishing the networks, etc., etc. So that's an important lesson. Where is AFRICOM in all of this? I think... And you might disagree with me. I think this feeds into to our Afghanistan discussions. I think AFRICOM has had a focus on kinetics. One of the reasons that they focused on kinetics is basically because development will take time, I think, and resources, and it's outside of their mandate. I do think that they might be trapped by some of the unfortunate repercussions of both Western, both European and American military doctrine, this loss awareness that are very important, so you don't have this emphasis on local governance. And what worries me a little bit with both European countries and also United States is that you transfer this idea that you have to gather up and create basically unit security instead of engaging locally and accept more losses, because maybe Europe and United States cannot take that much losses and still maintain their presence anymore. I don't know. This is a bigger discussion that we could talk for long with. And there's a lot of people in this hall that has more competence on that than I have. But in my dreams, if I would see an ideal AFRICOM, I would see an AFRICOM that encourages rural village protection and understands the limitation of drone warfare and understands the limitation of the structures they support and the limitations of just pouring money into armies that doesn't have really that much social coercion. By the way, I would stress that United States and also Norway, in fact, participated in creating some of the world's worst armies in the struggle against jihadism in Africa. The Somali army, who had, I think in 2012, reported frontline strength, it's better now, but 3,000 men, and the desertation was counted into 30,000. So, you know, the desertation, the amount of deserted personnel is so much higher than the amount of frontline strength, which I think is historically quite unique. So we have to look beyond the kinetics, we have to look beyond the money, and we have to look into local security. And it's hard because it demands resources, but I think that's the step forward. Otherwise, you won't change that much. You can hedge against disasters, and that's one thing we managed to do. You know, if Shebab takes a lot of territory, Ethiopia and Kenya will come. If you have the failure in northern Mali, you know, basically France will come. And if you, when things happened in Borno, Chad in the end came, and some others as well. So you will have foreign interventions in order to hedge off situations that grow increasingly bad, but you won't really change the situation in the long term. It's like creating some kind of block towards territorial control. And that's interesting theoretically for me as a researcher. Each time you have attempts for territorial control by some of these jihadists in Africa, you will have some kind of international intervention blocking it if the local country cannot block it itself. Yeah.
So Stieg Hansen's book is Horn, Sahel, and Rift, Fault Lines of the African Jihad. Please join me in thanking Stieg.